on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today is a 93-year-old World War II veteran who served as a pilot in the U.S. Navy for 4 years, John Adams of Kingsburg, California, a native of Lindsay, California, which is famously home to the world's biggest olive, but also home to one of the more than 2,400 Americans who died at Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, musician second class James Harvey Sanderson. He had been Mr. Adams' best friend at Lindsay High School. And I think it would give us all a little perspective to learn a little more.
What can you tell us about him, the kind of person he was, why you guys were such great friends throughout high school?
Well, I developed an interest in good music, and he was a musician. As a matter of fact, when he was in high school, we were fortunate enough to have Hugo Flock as the instructor, and he was a German music instructor from Visalia, and he was a chicken farmer. So every day he would go to the Lindsay schools, and he started me in music. I think it was in the third or fourth grade.
What'd you play?
Clarinet.
Clarinet. All
right. And Harvey was a clarinetist. Harvey went to the state. It was a group of high schools, musicians, going in this particular case, I think, San Francisco.
It was like some kind of state honor band or
that's
something?
That's it, yeah. Yeah. And Harvey got first place 2 years in a row.
So he's the best high school clarinetist in the state.
Yes, right. Then he joined the Navy, and I went to the Navy School of Music, and he got into a Navy band, and he was aboard Arizona when I was in Pearl Harbor.
Yeah. So December 7th, 1941, you're back here in California. Mm-hmm. How did you find out about what happened at Pearl Harbor?
See, that was on a Sunday, as I recall. I was, we'd just gotten home from church. I was sitting in the living room listening to the news, and they interrupted what was going on to announce that Pearl Harbor had just been bombed. So, of course, we didn't know what the damage was, and that's the first I'd heard of it.
Did you know that that's where Harvey was?
Yes, I did. As a matter of fact, Harvey was home about a month before, and he said they were going to Pearl Harbor. And unfortunately, his father died about a week before, or just a few days before Pearl Harbor. And had she sent a message to the Navy, they would have sent him home.
Wow.
But she didn't, and I remember her telling me, she says, no, he was home just a month ago, and, you know, just don't bother him. And so that's the way that turned out, and she had to live with that the rest of her days.
Yeah. So heavy.
Yeah.
How much were you able to learn about what he'd been doing before the attack and or where he was when it happened? Did you get any kind of insight into what happened to him?
Well, I do know his station, his battle station was in the ammunition down below, handling ammunition, passing ammunition. So that's where he would be.
Which would have left him virtually zero chance at survival.
Oh, yeah.
When the Arizona was hit.
Mm-hmm.
Was it the night before he'd been performing a concert with the band there?
Yeah, in Honolulu.
Uh-huh.
And a mutual friend of ours and grew up with us and was in the Navy in Pearl Harbor. He went to this band concert in Honolulu the night before. And after the concert, he talked with Harvey. And then the next day, the next morning, he was gone.
Wow. I'm really glad you shared that because I think it's important for people to understand that when we get to December 7th every year and we talk about it, it's not just ships going up in flames. It's not just a number, more than 2,000 sailors who died that day. It's real people. It was your best friend mm-hmm. who died that mm-hmm. day. In the years since, have you been to the USS Arizona Memorial?
Yes. Yeah.
What was that like for you? What did you think about while you were there?
Oh, I don't think I can tell you. Mm-hmm. I don't think I could put it into words. I was in the Navy at the time, and this was during the war, and the Arizona was on the bottom, but they'd put a plank, 2-inch by 12-inch planks, out to the ship, which was not very far. So I got aboard the Arizona, that part of it, and then that's all I saw.
So you walked out on those planks, and you're standing basically right above this sunken ship, and you know that your friend is still down there.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And you made a statement earlier. You said the reason you chose flying for the Navy as opposed to the Air Corps was it is a greater chance of seeing action in the Pacific. In the Air Corps, just as likely to end up flying over Europe.
Oh, yes.
But in the Navy Air Corps, you're going to be most likely out there in the Pacific.
It worked out that way.
And it did. I want to make sure I'm clear. Are you saying that's because of what happened to Harvey? And that the enemy who did that to your best friend was the one that you wanted to fight?
I would have to say probably yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That must have had the influence.
So you were there during the war, mm-hmm. while the Arizona was still there, but the memorial had not been built yet.
No.
And now if you go there today, you take a boat out to this memorial, you can still see those tears, as they call them, tears of the Arizona, the drops of oil that bubble to the surface.
Right.
But you also see in beautiful white marble, I believe it is, the names of all the guys who died.
Yeah, I've been there.
You've seen Harvey's name on that wall?
Oh, yes, sure.
So, again, I know it's hard to even think about, and you said you couldn't put into words what it felt like during the war, but contrasting those two experiences, having been there while everything's fresh and been there more recently when America has built this memorial to honor people like your friend, how did that feel going back there and seeing the way it's preserved now and the way, hopefully, that legacy is maintained?
Oh, I was very happy about that, the way it's built. Yeah.
I hope I'm not belaboring the point here as we dwell on this part of it, but I want people to feel what you felt back then. And there was some power that arose in America at that time. They talked about awakening the sleeping giant, and posters were everywhere with a tattered flag saying, "Remember Pearl Harbor." And the song was on the radio, "Remember Pearl Harbor and go on to victory." And a lot of guys that I've talked to were motivated by that.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess maybe it's a hard question to answer. I guess what I wonder was, having such a personal connection to what happened there, was that motivation maybe more palpable for you because of Harvey?
Oh, I think it had an influence. I signed up for the Navy, I think it was in January of 42.
So only about a month after Harvey's death. And we're going to hear about some of the unique experiences you would eventually have. But first, I do want to add a little more background on that USS Arizona band that your friend Harvey was a part of, and from what I can tell, a major part of. If you go to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find a photo of the band taken 2 weeks before the Pearl Harbor attacks. Harvey is right up front with a saxophone in his hands. That was his secondary instrument behind the clarinet. He's right next to the band leader, musician first class Frederick Kinney. The band had been engaged in an ongoing competition called the Battle of Music, in which they matched up against the bands from other ships. The final round of that competition was scheduled for December 20th, but it would be canceled after the Arizona band became the only Navy band ever to be formed together, train together, go aboard ship together, fight together, and die together. After the attack, the other bands decided to award the grand prize trophy posthumously to the Arizona band, and that's something you'll learn if you ever have the privilege of visiting the USS Arizona Memorial at Pearl Harbor. You'll also see the name J.H. Sanderson on the wall, as we discussed. For about 40 years after Pearl Harbor, there was a persistent myth that was actually perpetuated at the Arizona Memorial itself, a myth that all 21 members of the band died in their sleep on that Sunday morning. The truth is that when general quarters sounded, they snapped to their battle stations, as Mr. Adams said, below deck, passing ammunition up for the Arizona's guns to fire at the enemy. They kept carrying out that duty until a Japanese bomb made the Arizona's magazine explode, killing the band and approximately 1,000 others in an instant. You'll find a link to more detailed information on that at hometownheroesradio.com, but I wanted to at least share a little bit of it here and add to our picture of John Adams' best friend, Harvey Sanderson. You said his fate helped point you in the direction of the Navy and the war in the Pacific.
Did you have an idea of what you wanted to do, or a plane that you wanted to fly, or the kinds of duties that you wanted to have?
The only thing I wanted to do was a multi-engine. And so I got into it. They had two airplanes. One was the B-25. They had a squadron of those. But the other one was PBY. But the only twin engine they had in Corpus Christi was the PBY. So I trained in the PBY.
A flying boat, the Catalina. And
right.
It would have been hard to see one of those around Lindsay growing up, huh? Not enough water for a PBY around there. You mentioned the training. Was that difficult? Was that dangerous? Was that challenging, the training you went through?
I couldn't say that it was dangerous. I didn't even think about that. I did what I was told. Well, I think the challenges were a daily in the cadet life. There was just daily. I was just so grateful that I was there because of the future that it offered. Then when I got my wings, why, I was just, I can't tell you how grateful I was.
As for that aircraft, the PBY Catalina, what was that like to fly?
That was wonderful because that had two engines, and I liked that. And what was in my mind was probably commercial aviation for a future.
And I'm just guessing that your training consisted of water takeoffs and landings?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Which is not the same as taking off and landing on terra firma.
Quite different.
Explain that to us. What is different about it?
The main difference is you have a lot of drag in the water when your hull hits and touches the water. It's very smooth if the water is smooth. But when the water is rough, then it's very, very rough. So when it touches the water, well, then there's so much drag on the bottom why you have to come back on the stick. And you slow down in a hurry, of course. But I just enjoyed it very much. And, of course, we had a PBY-2, I guess we called it. And that had wheels, so we got to land on the runways also.
Mm-hmm. So you were a pretty versatile pilot by this time, and I'm sure you were envisioning heading out to the Pacific and maybe flying around searching for a downed bomber crews or something?
Well, whatever they had for me.
What did they have for you?
Well, actually, they had a new airplane called the PBM, made by Martin. That was a real fine airplane, it turned out to be. But I graduated from Corpus Christi on the last day of the year. I was on my way to Norfolk, Virginia, to go into PBMs. When I got there, I found out that everybody was grounded because the PBMs were... They were having severe trouble blowing up on takeoff, and so those were grounded. Anyway, when they were accumulating pilots very rapidly, they were coming from three training bases. It was Corpus Christi and Pensacola and Jacksonville. And that went on for a week or two, and so every facility needed more pilots. And the admiral from the primary training command in Kansas City flew in one day, and he went from A to R down the alphabet and took all of those, and I was Adams. So I became a primary instructor, much to my disappointment.
You wanted to get over there into the war zone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And they said, no, we need you here to train some more guys.
Yeah. And that was a real disappointment.
There's so many questions I have for you. One, let's talk about this thing with the PBMs, because you stated it very matter-of-factly, but if people were listening closely enough, they probably had their eyes open a second. You said when you get to Norfolk, the reason pilots are grounded was the PBMs were blowing up on takeoff, as in exploding, with everyone on board dying.
That's how I heard the news, anyway. And they found the problem in the design between the tanks and the hull. They had solid piping from one tank to the other instead of flexible. The hull itself had a lot of bending in it, you know, and it didn't take only a few fractions of an inch. So the leakage would start there at one of those connections. And then drip, and they didn't know it, of course. And gas would go down into the hull and bottom of the plane, and then eventually the fumes would get up to where there was a spark someplace, like throwing a switch there in the cockpit.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
And I don't want to be morbid here, but the upshot of this is quite a few guys were losing their lives because of a design flaw, basically.
Right. And I don't know how many planes they lost because of that.
But timing is everything. Mm-hmm. If you were there a couple of weeks earlier, you might have been one of those guys who blew up in a PBM.
Right. Yeah, well, Roberts, who was my roommate and going through cadets, he was R, so they didn't take him. It just went from A to R. And so he was very fortunate to have stayed, I thought. And he thought he was too, and he was ribbing me about becoming an instructor for the primary. Not too many months later, the same thing happened to him in San Francisco Bay. And That's all I know. And I thought it was taken care of, but maybe something else happened.
So here you're disappointed to be stuck in the States training other guys.
Yeah.
He's excited that he's going to get a chance to go fly.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you're envious of his position.
Yeah.
Until he's killed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stories that we hear on this program are guys that were, you know, in a war zone. Maybe they were on the ground getting shelled by 88s in Europe, or, you know, they were flying fighter planes or bomber planes in combat against the enemy. And to this point, you haven't shared any of those kind of stories, but you're also talking about some of the lives that were lost in this war. And when mm-hmm. we talk of over 406,000 Americans who died in World War II, I don't think people think about or realize how many died just trying to figure out how all this equipment was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
The training deaths.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if that were happening today, I wonder what the climate would be, what the publicity would be.
Well, during war, there's no publicity, very little. So it's highly restrictive. So that's a good question that you asked, and how would the civilian population react? Of course, the civilian population was gung-ho all the way.
Mm.
See?
Different.
Entirely different. You could just feel it. It was an amazing time. It really was.
So for you, I mean, for instance, here you are, you've got your wings, you're wearing this Navy uniform, and you know that you've got two other brothers in the service, and then your other brother and your other sister and your parents are all behind you,
mm-hmm.
all wanting the same thing.
My sister did. She joined the WACS.
Did she?
Yeah, and a brother joined the Navy, and the youngest brother got into the Army, but everything was over by that time.
Well, and again, that's something that's very different from today's world, where people maybe don't understand how universal this was, how united our country was. So I'm glad you're sharing that. But for you, when you hear of the plane that you're supposed to be flying exploding on takeoff, when you find out your buddy Roberts, who you thought had the plum job, is killed because of an incident with his airplane, does any of that make you wonder about what you're doing and if this is dangerous work and if maybe your life's in danger?
I'm sure it did to some extent, but I can't elaborate on that, though.
And what about that duty? Because this was important duty, too, as an instructor. Because these young men, these cadets, their lives are, in a way, in your hand and the instruction you give them, right?
Yeah.
So did you get to the point where you actually enjoyed that or found some fulfillment in the training?
I was so disappointed when I got the orders to Bunker Hill, Indiana. I went to the superintendent of aviation training and asked him how I could get out of there, transfer out of there. And he said, there is only one way I know, or something like that. He said, that is, you're going to get orders after I leave. And he says, your job is to do your job and do it the best you can. And I said, yes, sir. And I did. And I never lost a student.
Hmm. That's something to be proud of. And eventually, you would get your wish and make your way to the Pacific. When we come back, we're going to find out how the missions Mr. Adams flew contributed in a very unique way to saving American lives. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Close to 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.